All right, we are rolling.
All right. All right, this is the eighth in a series of oral history interviews conducted by the University Archives and Special Collections Unit, Illinois Institute of Technology. Today is Tuesday, December 12, 2017. I am Ralph Pugh, University Archivist, and I am co-conducting this interview with Adam Strom, who is the Director of University Archives and Special Collections. Our guest today, although we are also your guests since we're in your office in the IIT Tower, is IIT's soon-to-be former Provost and Senior Vice President, Francis Braunett, who's held those two positions since July 1st, 2015. We thank you for taking time from your especially busy schedule, given that 3 weeks from today you take up your new position as President of Pratt Institute in Brooklyn. So thanks for having us. I'll lead off with the first question. Oftentimes we ask people for a statement about their formative experiences, whether it was your upbringing, your personal upbringing, or your initial decisions about what your life would look like, what your initial plan was when you were a teenager moving forward. Looking at your resume, and of course, as everyone knows, you've had this splendid career, which on surface appears to have been perfectly scripted, but we know that that has to be illusory. Obviously, there have been things happening along the way where you've had to rely more upon that upbringing, upon that internal sense of who you are to be able to make those decisions moving forward. So we'll start off with that question and where you come from.
So I'm originally from Montreal, mm-hmm. and I grew up in a family where my mother's Canadian, my father's a Holocaust survivor, and I grew up in a Holocaust neighborhood, neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So the neighborhood was pretty limited and was bounded by multiple other neighborhoods that were various groups of immigrants. So mm-hmm. Haitian, I would say some Greek, some Italian, but the core was a mix of immigrants from Eastern Europe mm-hmm. and from Northern Africa, so from Tunisia and Morocco,
okay.
all Jewish.
Okay.
And so my core group of sort of neighbors and community were in elementary school. I grew up in basically 90% of the children I grew up with came from a very similar, if not identical, background. See,
okay.
that's what I thought. Okay, so
mm-hmm.
if my husband were in here, he would say, I projected all of what I just told you, I projected upon everybody around me. That we would all go to college, that we would all, all had. No resources. My parents, we never owned anything. We had a little apartment, and we had, I have one younger brother, and I had an aunt who had learning disabilities who stayed with us. So we had 800 square feet, five people in the apartment. That would be off and on. My aunt actually traveled amongst sisters. So when we were the youngest kids in the sort of family, so she was our babysitter until we outgrew her, and I outgrew her at five. So she was in our house, but I no longer listened to anybody who, I was in charge. So I think that I was in charge at a very young age. My parents, my mother went back to work as soon as I was seven, and my brother was in kindergarten. So I was at home. I would take care of whatever had to be done, lunches. We lived across the street from the elementary school. And then as I went to high school, my high school actually had also been a very similar demographic until probably 2 or 3 years before I got there, and the city was redistricted because they put the DeCary Expressway through, and in the redistricting, a school that had been primarily white Jewish kids of survivors now was a third black, and this faculty didn't know how to deal with this kind of new demographic. Lot of tension, lot of upheaval, lot of stress, a lot of violence in our high school,
right.
and of just negotiating a kind of new reality. So that was my high school. I said everybody went to college, but it turns out that only a few of us did. But we had a lot of very driven kids, except that they were all in the enriched classes, and we were shepherded off to college. My father only finished second grade. My mother didn't finish eighth grade. So although that sounds like, oh my God, you're first generation of high school, mm-hmm. my brother also has a PhD and is a faculty mm-hmm. member. So the two of us, whatever sure, happened sure. in oh, that house, yeah, right. We had no yeah. books, yeah. we had no music, uh-huh. we had True Confessions, you know, mm-hmm. magazines. I don't know what. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. it was really amazing. Wow. So, mm-hmm. but I was I didn't spend any time home ever. Mm-hmm. That has continued in my life. Okay. I was always out. I thought everybody was always out mm-hmm. in my sort of new...
So it all seemed natural to you.
Yeah, no, I thought all the mm-hmm. kids were out. It turns out everybody else was only out one or two nights a week. I was out all nights of the uh-huh. week, but there was uh-huh. a sort of rotating group of people. Uh-huh. By the time I got to college or thought about college, and my parents, it was very clear I had to do something that was going to bring in money. Mm-hmm. I did not want to be a doctor, a lawyer or an accountant, which were the three that were sort of offered to me, mm-hmm. if I was not going to be a secretary. So in my household, going out and being bringing revenue to the house was really significant. Mm-hmm. So I was working by the time I was probably 7 or 8 with paper routes, then babysitting, mm-hmm. yeah. then working in, you know, cashier. So my brother and I were both contributing in some ways to the household. Mm-hmm. And so in any case, I, you know, people ask me what I wanted, and I always want to be dramatic. So I would say, well, I want to be, you know, a lunar architect or the head of a think tank. So that was an early part of my life. And of course, now that when I give talks, I always say, well, what is a provost but the head of a think tank? So in fact, you know, that has emerged. I did go into engineering. I was not really interested in engineering when I started. Okay. And I went in because I heard it was the hardest discipline to go into. Mm-hmm. So in Quebec, mm-hmm. you leave at 17 years old from high school, and you do 2 years of CEGEP, which is basically like community college. Mm-hmm. When I went in, it was still part of McGill and part of the university system. Mm-hmm. It changed. We were the last group cohort for that. It became a separate community college system. It wasn't embedded in the university. So I went into engineering thinking, I'd go into engineering. If I didn't pass, I would go into hard sciences, which would be physics. Mm-hmm. If I didn't pass, I'd go into biological sciences. If I didn't pass, I would mm-hmm. go into liberal arts. So I had a lot of ladder runs I could fail in. Uh-huh, uh-huh, needless to uh-huh. say, I didn't fail. Yeah, and But while I was doing the engineering, I actually finished first year of engineering while I was doing those 2 years of CEGEP, of college. Mm-hmm. And once I had done 1 year, there were only 2 years after that, mm-hmm. I said, well, I may as well finish it, but I really wanted to go into architecture. So I did 2 degrees simultaneously, architecture and engineering. Oh, right. And I graduated about the same time with 3 degrees, Bachelor of Architecture, Bachelor of Science in Architecture, Bachelor of Engineering, mm-hmm. within a year and a half. Uh-huh. So did that. I was always teaching. I was always tutoring. I was always guiding. I tutored mm-hmm. for much of my elementary and high school life. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. becoming a teacher was not... I knew that was going to happen. I was actually, mm-hmm. I worked all day and I started to teach at nights, both at McGill as well as at one of these CEGEPs that emerged.
Sure.
And after I opened a practice, after 7 years in practice, I realized I had to go back to school to get a graduate degree in order if I wanted to be a faculty member. Did that. This is taking a long time. I did that. I thought I would become an adjunct. I went to Columbia. I thought I would become an adjunct at one of these institutions while I was building my practice in New York. I started building a house for a client in Southampton. Mm-hmm. And then I was offered a tenure-related job. That's a long story, but anyway, offered a tenure-related job at RPI. Took that job to teach both engineering to architects as well as design. Mm-hmm. I did that for 20 years. Embedded within that, I went all the way to become a full professor, sure. and I also... was an associate dean, I was acting dean. I launched a program with two extraordinary colleagues in product design and innovation. Mm-hmm. So building new models for education was critical for me as well. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All three of us kind of launched our careers differently. One became the chair of the department. We did this as much younger faculty members, and I left to become the dean of architecture and allied arts at the University of Oregon, and another is now the dean of engineering at Villanova, who mm-hmm. he was just here doing the MMAE external review. Mm-hmm. I hadn't seen him in a long time. Uh-huh. So, yeah. So,
Do you feel you're a natural extrovert, or given the requirements of your upbringing?
No, I'm a natural extrovert.
You're natural.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
so
no,
that was fortuitous that came together.
Yeah, no, I'm an extreme extrovert. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And in the academy, that's an unusual thing to be, mm-hmm, one. Mm-hmm. And architects are introverts statistically.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
So the combination for me opened up a huge platform that wouldn't have been open for somebody else, because I actually, mm-hmm, enjoy doing the things everybody else says,
so
oh my God, don't ask me.
Those requirements,
right.
So those opportunities for interdisciplinary work, that you had the natural proclivity toward that.
Correct, and also the desire, I also am somebody always, when people say you can't do that or don't do,
mm-hmm,
that,
mm-hmm,
my,
mm-hmm,
automatic reaction is, don't tell,
mm-hmm,
me that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a street kid thing. You can't tell me I can't get that done.
Yeah, that's a definite.
Yeah.
That's a definite. How much of the issue that you're a woman in the early 1970s moving forward? Again,
zero.
It's not.
No,
did you
not,
find any pushback in any of these
never,
sort of cultural
other than my father
context?
Saying, please get married, don't tell anybody you're smart, maybe you should be a secretary, learn how to type.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a lot of mixed messages. Education is critical. It's the only thing you can carry with you, blah, blah. You know, because obviously if you're, Holocaust survivor, the only thing you can take with you is your brain. So
yeah,
we
right.
heard that over
yeah.
and over and over again.
Yeah.
But aside from that, I think my father's biggest concern was that I was not going to get married, I wouldn't have kids, and he believed that was the most important thing in the universe, is mm-hmm. to have kids. By the time I was 35 and I was still pushing away at my career, he said to me, there are single mothers by choice. My father was like, what? Who are you? Anyhow,
yeah.
But I think the resilience of not having any resources,
mm-hmm.
So nothing ever daunts me. When
right.
people tell me they don't have any resources,
yeah.
really?
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry.
It can be liberating
coming
from the working class or situations
right.
like that, because you don't have parents who are trying to put you in any particular avenue of
oh no, it's so liberating. My kids
right.
don't have that luxury,
mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
So I think mm-hmm.
yeah. Adam, do you want
to? Sure. So I think it's pretty safe to say, given the background you've kind of just gone over with us, that it's not the same old background that a lot of people would bring to your position, especially here at IIT. Your kind of work that bridges between architecture and engineering, but then also veers into art, is something that, I would guess that you're fairly unique here. amongst present and former members of administration.
I'm going to guess so. I'm going to guess so.
And I'm wondering what you see as kind of the cachet that you bring, or the strengths that you bring that maybe this campus was in need of when you arrived.
So I think that I'm a relationship builder. It's just what I do. Mm-hmm. I can't live personally without relationships. So they're just an obvious thing in sort of building community is critical to me. I have to suppress my own autocratic, this is what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
and I do. I think that doesn't happen necessarily all the time in an institution when you have power. I think really people asked me what I was doing when I first arrived, and I said, well, I have to build my team. And I realized within a few weeks I had to build team culture. And I'm starting to see it here. I'm seeing people who before wouldn't do it either because everyone's so smart. We all believe we can just get it done ourselves. It would be so much faster. Well, it's faster, but has no traction. You're not building a landscape of extreme success, which is collective success. You're building your own journey,
mm-hmm.
and the opportunities are not an either or situation. Mm-hmm. Is that mm-hmm. if your fundamental way of operating is to see a trajectory and go there,
mm-hmm.
and you're
mm-hmm.
really a genius and an expert in getting there,
mm-hmm.
nobody wants to diminish that. The question
mm-hmm.
is, are we missing a whole other set
mm-hmm.
of opportunities by not collaborating? So you want to sort of push against any hegemony, that it doesn't really matter what it is.
Mm-hmm.
I would say if everybody was collaborating, you're losing some genius streaks.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually have to build an ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, I've always thought about this place as an ecosystem. When you don't have
mm-hmm.
enough of one or the other, you're going to have failure. Mm-hmm. And so we see it, for example, we've seen it in the business school. Mm-hmm. They decided that they're going to grow. They went 90% into one country's immigrants from China. It changed a little bit. Boom, it collapsed. Yeah. We have the same situation now, unpredictable sort of leadership at the university, at the country level. We stop some visas. Boom.
Right.
So
right.
I think we see it with respect to enrollment. We have to diversify. And we always have to be prescient about thinking about that, even when you can never be secure. So I think that's obviously something, you know, in my life was like, there's a mantra an economist told me, but I think if my father had that language, he would have said it, which was, you want to minimize maximum regret. How do you do that? You do as many things as you can, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Engineering, architecture, I also have a diploma in business because, you never know, right? I worked with engineers, but I also work with performers. I've worked with people who are, traditionally able-bodied, and those who have had to use very different abilities that we wouldn't have recognized before.
That's true.
All of my, even my performance work or my product design work in terms of building curricula, have always been a team based. If you asked, so I remember asking my husband, I said, I don't know if I should work on this dance project or work on these, on this book with a colleague of mine looking at feminist practices. And he said, well, it doesn't really matter to you, Francis. As long as you're partnering, you actually don't care what the project is. And so that's been important.
You know, those, the three of us on this side of the table are old enough to remember the ecological movement of the early 70s and our being schooled when we were younger in the importance of diversity, ecological diversity and all manner of things. Of course, that also ties in with your own upbringing and realizing that you need to be practical and whatnot. So that is a continuity moving forward. And we don't talk about sort of ecological models as much anymore as we used to. But yeah, they're important. And so that is a guiding philosophy of yours throughout so much of this. People working together.
Absolutely.
All right, don't leave me and whatnot.
Right.
So wow, that's a great strength. And so coming to IIT, that's what you are able to do, to be able to look at the various departments and say, let's not become too monocultural here or think that one solution is going to work a wonder.
Honest, what I wish for, I mean, to build an ecosystem takes a long, long time. Obviously, I've been here for 2.5 years, certainly not enough. But I think for a few people who might have not known that that's a model, that it could be a really good model was shocking. And that, and they've gone in those directions. People are open. There are others who, they're not ready. And they're maybe that's okay. Again, in the ecosystem, it's okay that there's some people who are actually going to stay in their, on their road, on their track.
Okay.
They're not getting off. Because you do need, you need a foil. And you need a challenge. So, but most of us do know that you can't do, a lot of big work today can't be done in any single discipline alone. And you do need partners for great work. It doesn't mean you can't be, in some ways, a singular force, but there are going to be things, and it, in a university like this, you're going to have PhD students, you're going to have colleagues that, you know, the big grants that you want to work on, even though it's going to be your expertise that's going to be central, there's going to have to be some other inputs. And the one thing that I, that if I had a little bit more time would have cultivated more is all the relationships that we have with other institutions around, you know. So obviously we have grants that are going with University of Chicago, not so much with Northwestern, some with University of Illinois, Chicago, mostly we just steal their faculty. And, of course, Argonne and Fermilabs. And one of the dilemmas about that, which I think is a model for the future, is that means that you eviscerate the social fabric of the university because they're not here. Mm-hmm. So there's a pros and cons of seeing a university as part of a larger ecosystem of Chicago, but it also means that core faculty are not walking through the halls by going from their lab to their classroom on the same level of regularity that you would see in college town, for example, because there aren't those other resources. Mm-hmm. So how we, you know, how we deal with that, and I think it actually frames the future of when we're going to be a lot more online. Mm-hmm. And so how do you build a social fabric while there's distance engaged? Because ultimately, you know, everyone's talking about changing the university in many, many different ways. Mm-hmm. One of which is, well, we're not just going to serve 18 to 22-year-olds. Well, we already don't, right? Because we're mostly a graduate institution.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Many people go to graduate school not just to get a better job. Mm-hmm. They might say that, and their parents are sending them from India here to get a return on their investment. They're also meeting partners. Mm-hmm. You know, they're meeting friends. They're meeting future, collaborators.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Those things are done face to face. Ultimately, even you have online dating. Eventually, you have to meet.
Yeah, absolutely. Quick question: working with Alan Cramp, who also is born overseas and is very alive to the, I hear some similarities in his discourse and in yours. Have you benefited from that team to be able to try to shift the culture here at IIT to be thinking much more ecologically and in terms of diversity and along those lines? I'm not articulating that very
so
well.
So let me talk about diversity a different way. Alan and I probably hit diversity very differently.
Okay.
So when I talk about the ecosystem, I'm fundamentally talking about diversity as well.
Yeah.
But we would have to pull that out in terms of, you know, equity and inclusion. Diversity.
Okay.
Alan, he actually, it is something that's so present for him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that's about, but if he's going to make a decision between two candidates, he automatically goes to the diverse hire.
Okay.
That's just who he is.
Okay. All right.
That is a really unusual situation. I'm just telling you. Mm-hmm. He doesn't go to, well, maybe it would work, maybe it won't. It's immediate. I don't get it. Why wouldn't we just go with the woman, the person of color, that's his automatic, which is fascinating because I probably don't automatically go. I question it. I keep opening up. And so that's been fascinating for me.
Mm-hmm.
We are, in many ways, I would say, opposite in terms of our the ways that we engage.
Okay.
He's very, very, very pragmatic, very thoughtful, there's a very strict process and practice that he understands, like from the get-go. Like the handbook is a something you follow, you know. And I forget. As the provost, you're not allowed to forget, you know, and I have to go back to it often to kind of, it's something that actually he respects deeply and is guided by. That's one example. So I think actually we do have a very complementary way of being in the world. It really helps me because he also is quicker to decisions. And so I spend a lot of time ruminating before a decision is made, and a lot of interviewing and a lot of speaking to people. And sometimes that's good, sometimes that's daunting. I think ultimately a good thing, and that's why it works well, because he'll push me to move it quicker. Now, never to the point where it would be uninformed. That would absolutely not occur.
Yeah. But there's certainly a lot of shared overlap in terms of agenda.
I think more importantly, there's a kind of ethical core that we agree on.
All right.
And Everything else, you can make work.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
you can't if your principles are off.
Okay.
You know, and I think fundamentally we share very similar principles. Mm-hmm. I also came here for, I would say there was four or five key things I came for. I came because what I knew already of ID and architecture was that it was world-renowned.
Mm-hmm.
I already knew about that, you know. So I knew that. When I read about iPro, blown away. Mm-hmm. I said, oh my mm-hmm. God, that's exactly
sure.
what I've been doing,
sure.
except I was never able to get it across the curriculum. Mm-hmm. So an incredibly rich, you know, framework for the kind of work that I had already been doing nationally. I've been taking mm-hmm. the same project nationally. The Kaplan Institute,
mm-hmm.
which of
mm-hmm.
course is another manifestation of an opportunity to think interdisciplinarily.
Mm-hmm.
The relationship of being in a major city mm-hmm. where much of it has been defined by the graduates that come from this school, whether mm-hmm. it's in architecture, mm-hmm. The landscape of the place, and now we're seeing in the tech ecosystem. Mm-hmm. Very, very critical players emerging yeah. from here. So those were some very key things about the institution.
Mm-hmm.
And Alan, those are very key things for him mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Oh, yeah. It's great to hear the term ethical and ethos and moving with it. So, yeah.
So you know, a lot of what you talk about in terms of building teams and collaboration and kind of people being on the same page. One of the things I wanted to ask you about that this made me thought of is the transition to and from Oregon. So you're at mm-hmm. RPI for mm-hmm. quite a while. IIT, similar in size to RPI. Pratt, fairly
similar.
And then there's, and all three are urban-ish,
mm-hmm.
you know,
well, not RPI.
Okay.
Not urban-ish. No, it's in 50,000.
Don't give that
urban,
a try.
Urban adjacent.
Urban adjacent. Oh, yeah. I like that.
And so then there's Eugene. And then there's the University of Oregon. And so, you know, I'm wondering, given the way that you like to work and the way that you like to build collaborations and, you know, put teams together, you know, I was just wondering, like, what your experience was on a campus that big and whether when you came to IIT, whether you were looking again for that smaller kind of system to work within?
No. I'm ecumenical.
Okay,
About everything. I'm really ecumenical about everything. Weather, city, not city, water, no water.
Okay.
But I'm not ecumenical about people.
Okay.
So there are good people everywhere. That's the goal. Find the people, do your project. So remember, I spent 9 years as the dean of a college which had 9 departments, 9 centers, 9 or 10, depending on how you counted it. We had 2 campuses, one in Portland, one in Eugene. I actually kind of laugh because I feel like this is like Eugene and Adams is like Portland. Like, it's so bizarre. It's like the same. And in Eugene, we had, you know, in Portland, we had one big building, very similar, like so similar to the Adams building. And in it, similar disciplines. We were the anchor tenant, architecture and allied arts, where we had basically digital arts, product design, and architecture were there. They were also on the main campus, but they also, then journalism and communications joined us, then business joined us. It's like identical, right? And and then more buildings actually started to get to grow up around Old Town, Chinatown. It was an area that was abandoned, and basically you put a university building and the whole place started to flourish. So I think it's interesting. I actually never put it together. Small, big, small. You know, it didn't even enter my mind. The cities have, people would say when they meet me, like, we don't even know what you were doing in Eugene or Troy. Like, you know, I have good friends from all over the world that are, like, still scratching. You've got to get out of these towns. I love those towns because I had extraordinary friends and colleagues. Extraordinary. Everywhere. And so Eugene is tiny. The university is bigger. But college towns, both RPI and Eugene, so RPI, I call it RPI because basically the faculty did not live anywhere near RPI. They used to, but the city, you know, got the schools, districts sort of changed and everybody moved to the suburbs. So most of the faculty, no, except for the architects and the artists, nobody lived in Troy. The people concerned with cultural, you know, the cultural artifacts of a city, we stayed in near the campus. Everybody else was out in the suburbs. In Oregon, in Eugene, everybody you could roll out of bed and get to, you know, pretty close. Well, I guess even you lived in the suburbs of Troy. I mean, Troy had 50,000 people, so the suburbs were not like that far. So I think for me, the shock of coming to Chicago was that people don't hang around the campus. 5 o'clock, it's like a ghost town. That's that was surprising to me. And it will be the same in New York because the commute is 1.5 to 2 hours for a lot of people. And they have young kids, and certainly a lot of the staff, a lot of the young faculty, they have kids, so they live in the suburbs where they can have, you know, good school districts, and they can have soccer, and they can have Little League. That's really different, because when you live in a small town like Troy or Eugene, all that stuff was really close, and people didn't have to skedaddle at 5 o'clock, or, and actually they didn't have to catch a train, right? You could just get in your car, and 10 minutes later, you were home. And in both of those places, that was the situation. No one commuted more than 10 or 15 minutes maximum, walking, biking, or so I think those were the bigger differences. The big university, when by the time I became provost, I had been there for 9 years, and somebody like me knew everybody, right?
Yeah.
So there wasn't anybody on the campus, even though there were 25,000 students, that I didn't know, whether they were staff and faculty. I pretty much, I would say, I walk in a room, I would know 90% of the people. Partly because you'd see them everywhere, right? You'd see them in town, and you'd see them on the campus. Here, we just had a big Christmas party yesterday. I looked around the room, and I don't know a lot of those people. Because at 5, and I stick around, so I'm here late, and there is nobody here. And I'll walk around the campus, and the students, but I don't see the faculty or staff. They're gone. So I think, and actually that makes the job a little harder and very easy. So the harder part for me is I'm trying to build teams, and my days are slammed with meeting after meeting after meeting. When do I have time? At 5 or 6 o'clock, everyone's gone. So I can't do that. Two, what makes it easy is everyone's gone at 5 o'clock. You have a lot of time to do your own work. You know, like I can catch up. You know, so I think, and this university, there isn't a lot of baggage. You know, this is the normal stuff that happens at any university, but it doesn't have all the other stuff. It doesn't have huge political brouhaha. It doesn't have that a provost would be very embedded. I can tell you what was going on at Oregon. So we had archives release that was done. That was a disaster, caused a huge mess. You might have heard about it. Archives release. We had records release out of the health services. Not good. Confidential records that were released. We had multiple rapes. We have athletic and Greek culture, which has its own set of issues, sometimes having nothing to do with problems, but creating other kinds of anxieties. We had a meningitis outbreak. We had a graduate student strike, and the faculty were all became unionized, and they decided the people who were actually in management, who were chairs of departments, they thought they should support the strike. You're in management! So that kind of stuff ate up 95% of my time. I actually launched a strategic plan there I think it took up 3% of my time. Mm. Here, it would take up, the amount it should take up, 20 or 30% of your time. Mm. Mm-hmm. There's, what's great about this place is it isn't riddled with all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. It would be great if there was a little bit of, you know, freedom of speech stuff.
Yeah,
and, you
yeah,
know,
sure.
But that's
yeah, sure.
But they actually are talking about it. But because our students mm-hmm. and our faculty are problem solvers, mm. they go, that's not the most effective thing to do. For us to protest and scream and, you know, run up on a stage and grab people's papers out of their hands, mm-hmm. Not pragmatic. Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. I think there's a mm-hmm. better way to do things. Mm-hmm. So that's what our students are like, and our mm-hmm. faculty. Mm-hmm. And they don't like that level of disorder, this mm-hmm. particular demographic. There are absolutely a few of those people here, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but because the norm is to not do that, mm-hmm. they actually get they work within the culture, even if they're protesters, mm-hmm. and understand that if they do that, their colleagues are not supporting them. So they're like in a weird spot. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So my worry about them is that they get bullied inappropriately, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. the majority yeah. is much more
sure.
conservative.
Position to do that.
Yeah,
yes.
And there's much more inertia to solve problems, not to create problems. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. and they see us creating problems. It's not challenging the status quo. It's what are you doing that for? You know, we can mm-hmm, talk. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm.
Do you see this sort of problem solver approach and all of the things that go with it? Is that something that you also saw at RPI? Is it a small tech or STEM school?
Absolutely.
Kind of thing?
It's in every tech school. So mm-hmm. if you look and you actually study what happened during the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. tech schools didn't do anything. They were just studying. Too much work. Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm. two things. Too much work and first gen. Mm-hmm. So the combination, and so they're coming from parents who say, don't rock the boat. You learned mm-hmm. all your life, don't rock the boat. Just, mm-hmm. you put your blinders on and you just study and you're going to do well. They're not coming from a background of, like, my kids think it's okay to protest everything, right? Not mm-hmm. both of my kids. But my yeah. STEM kid, no. Uh-huh. My liberal arts kid, yes. You know, and mm-hmm. He's got too much work to do. Mm. I don't think she had enough work to do. mm-hmm. Of course, that's my bias, right? Yeah, is that I was a maniacal workaholic. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I didn't have any time for that, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. political stuff. But I went to Columbia deliberately because it was one of the hotbeds for political unrest in the 60s.
Certainly.
And when I was there, just by good luck, it was all the anti-apartheid stuff about divesting
yeah.
was happening when I was there. But as an mm-hmm. architecture student, you know, I did sit in the protests, mm-hmm. but I didn't have a lot of space for that. I couldn't yeah. do it on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. We had too much work to do.
Yeah.
And that's the student here. And it is mm-hmm. absolutely a tech school, but I think it is the combination. And there are probably a few other factors. Mm-hmm. If you're an immigrant, you're not raising anything,
sure.
first of all. And independent of the current situation, as a kid of immigrants, I didn't ever raise my head in Canada thinking, mm-hmm. oh my God, they're going to deport me, they'll throw me in a camp. There's it's so embedded within you. So as an immigrant kid or first generation, do your work, and the nature of the work itself, mm-hmm. that combination is going to, it creates a particular way of being in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, mm-hmm. again, it's a curve, there's a lot in the middle, and there's all these other, you know, agitations, but, yeah.
Yeah. Have you felt, however, given your ability to think very broadly and holistically, what IIT might need by way of corrective in terms of greater discourse on campus, in terms of healthy but still very real avenues for student input on governance and their role in society, not just simply their technocratic posture?
So I think that the leadership of the student bodies, and there are many, right, from the Student Government Association to the Student Advisory Committee that advises Alan, mm-hmm. to the Union Board, mm-hmm. to all of the 60 club leadership, mm-hmm. those are actually the students who are thinking about the broader condition. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are many others that are just quiet and they don't do that collectively. That's where you'll see, what are we doing about free speech? What are we doing? And they will come and bring those questions. Mm-hmm. But what we say, in the same way with the faculty, is say, why don't we open a discourse about this? Let's have a discussion. Mm-hmm. And so now, for example, around the issues of freedom of speech, the students and the faculty are meeting. What would they say? And they're not on the same place, I can tell you. Mm-hmm. The faculty believe all things should be, we should be able to do anything. The students say, follow the code of conduct. And the code of conduct says, if you're going to pull out a different, you're going to say that group doesn't belong, or you're not allowed on the campus. So they're actually, their code of conduct actually may, who knows if it's even legal. And by the way, the code of conduct is the same as every code of conduct in the country. Mm-hmm. And it basically says, we don't tolerate discrimination, harassment, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But we allow these people to come and speak, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I said, so how are we going to make that happen? This, well, they're allowed to come now, but they have to come with other voices. You're allowed to come, but you'll never get the single platform.
Okay.
So that's really fascinating.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, at Oregon, there's no way you would bring somebody from the, you know, World Economic Forum speaking. Here, that's fine. They're not allowed to speak at Oregon, I can tell you that. So remember, this is also a school that takes a lot of money from defense agencies.
Sure, always has.
A place like Oregon, it's a maximum of 5% from taking anything from DOD or anything like that.
Yeah.
Even if it's looking at pancreatic research, you know.
Yeah. How are we doing time-wise?
I think you're okay.
Well, we should maybe start to look towards the end of this, just to be cognizant of your schedule. So something that we've asked a few other people that are kind of outgoing when we've spoken to them is kind of a question of, you know, things they're proud of or legacy. And it's an especially interesting question, I think, given your tenure here, that other people we've talked to have, decades of time to go back and say, well, this little seed that I planted, I've seen it come to fruition. And
the green line, the red line.
Stories, yes. Yeah. But I'm interested. I'm sure you've done some reflection, or maybe not. Maybe you've been working so hard that you'll do the reflection on the plane to New York. But I'm wondering, looking back on your time here, what you see as either the things you're proudest of or your kind of hallmark.
Yeah. So people, here's what people will say. They'll say, okay, so we shepherded the Nair Prize, you know, and so, you know, two sessions of the $1 million prize and getting. And what was great about that was not the prize, but the fact that people had to collaborate to come up with something that was going to solve a significant social problem.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that, so for me, the critical part was that social doesn't enter every discussion we have, but it was present there. Mm-hmm. Now, if you ask the deans of science and engineering, they'll say, absolutely, we do not solve problems if we're not thinking about what are the consequences in society. But social is actually something other. Social is the engagement of me to you. A lot of people here think a social problem is pollution. That's not a social problem. It's using solar is a tech fix. It's not about, in order to use solar, how will humans be engaged with the delivery of that energy? If they're just in a Taylor-esque line, why is that any different than if they were doing a different kind of energy? So I think the issue of opening up that so for people around me who were working with me, they began to understand social was face to face and not that technology itself is tools, techniques, and social stuff, so that you cannot think of a technology without understanding that people are actually going to have to employ that and what's the nature of their engagement. But most faculty here would just see social as I saved you money, I saved you energy. Those are not social issues. So I think that's a critical piece.
Okay.
another piece, which other people would say is working on the Kaplan, getting the academic director, planning it, making sure the different cohorts from IPRO to the Institute of Design could figure out how to live, and also the Kaplan Institute live and cohabitate. We're not there yet. There's still some tension, but they're all coming to the table. And I will tell you, what often happens here is we do things serially as opposed to in parallel or together. Okay. So this person does this and the next person, and then there's a screw up because you never got to the table together. Yeah. But there's some examples here that are unbelievable. There's a student success committee, volunteers from every unit on this campus that meet on a weekly basis, volunteers, to talk about each kid that might be falling through the cracks. Mm. This is a remarkable thing that I have never heard of before. Mm. Usually that's, you know, it's institutionalized, and these are just extraordinary volunteers from, they could be coming from financial aid and from academic affairs, and they're from everywhere, student affairs, health services, and they all, and they're like 20 of them in a crappy room meeting to really do extraordinary things with our students. Yeah. Supporting that kind of thing for me was critical.
That's a great example.
Getting the deans to think together, you know, and we're not there, not there. I would say thinking big about the institution. So how do we make sure it's fiscally resilient, but we have transformational ideas present? And to not be afraid of bandying about big ideas. So whether they're around themes, like we're going to look at food and environment, right? So iFish is going to meet with Wiser, and they're going to figure something out. And they are, right? They are doing that. On the other hand, for me, it was really about that the people of iFish, we're going to talk to the people of Wiser. Let's just talk to each other, you know, or admissions, being able to work with financial aid. Admissions and financial aid working with academic affairs. That the retention and the enrollment of our students are actually the same. Lifelong learning, coming up with new models for lifelong learning at the institution, that's beginning here too. But I don't think I was the prompt, I was just the supporter. You know, people had big ideas, and I was interested in shepherding, saying, okay, go. Having people come to me with something that they think they can manage and do, and I'll say, great idea, go run with it. Now, more importantly, what I needed to do, and I think I did for some but not all, is build a rubric for them to be successful in that implementation, which always had to do with communication. Because we do a lot of things here. People come up with really good ideas, they throw them out there, and they completely backfire because no one did any of the participatory democracy, democratic foundational pieces that they needed to do, which means you're trying to put this idea out there. You have to meet with your group, make sure your group knows what you're doing so that when they happen to be at the cafeteria, they know how to talk about it. But then all the groups have to get together and know what their strengths are and then come to the table to share those things. If we don't do that preliminary work, there's failure. And that I've seen that a few times where initiatives were not, they were baked in somebody's head, but they weren't, they were too baked. And people didn't feel that they could contribute. And so getting people to contribute to ideas so that everybody shares the construction of it. It's very different than a buy-in. Because I don't buy the buy-in business. People tell you they bought in and they didn't. I would say that it was more about trying to get people to even think there are other models out there. Again, breaking the hegemony and not just following the practices that exist that, you know, and I don't want to say the silos. I think there are a lot of people who do work across domains, but it is easier to work on your own stuff, especially, by the way, when the time constraint's so tight here because people are leaving so quickly. You know, whereas you'll see it much more with students who are here around the clock, like the architects, they're here all the time.
Yeah.
There's an opportunity to actually build coalitions. The difficulty is that we also have such different cultures. So architects work 24/7, engineers work from 9 to 5, business works from 2 to 3. I'm making light of something, but actually they actually look down on the other culture that can't get the work done in this period of time. Others that say, oh my God, you're not spending enough time. And because that's my background, is working across those disciplines, getting people to think like that.
Right, so you're this grand impresario in a way. To understand how the different cultures and helping them understand each other.
But they have to practice it. It is a practice, and it's a lot of hard work. And this is a place that where people aren't afraid of hard work. That's for sure. But we're seeing it with the young faculty and the students. They're willing to try anything, and they also know if the, you know, engineers less so. I think technologists are less so dominated by the. I think we're seeing liberal arts people are so afraid of what's happening to higher education that they just sort of hold on as hard as they can. Engineers have always been sort of more pragmatic, so the money's here, we'll go there. You know, humanities and social sciences less so. So getting people to open the box, not so difficult sometimes, but they have to, it has to be supported, and it has to be supported from here. I think one of the daunting things is we didn't have that many resources to actually incentivize people to do a lot. But they still did, you know, people still did.
Good.
Great.
All right. That looks like we're 3 minutes too.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to us, and thank you for your great work here. And best of luck in your new endeavors.
Thank you. And I don't think I said anything that I need to add.